Okay. So this conference is we just began the recording portion. It's 10 after 8. And I'm Dove, and I'm here because of people like you who were present at the first SA meeting I ever went to, people who were really serious about recovery and didn't come with bags over their heads or fake names. And we're real. So Baruch Hashem, there are people who I could buy real for free, real recovery from. And that's why I'm here today. And you're interested in recovery. That's why you're here. So that's something. And so am I. So I'm proud to be in the same cover with people like you. I just wanted to repeat, as I do many times, and I'm going to keep doing till I can't do it anymore, to paraphrase Bill Clinton, I'm gonna just keep mentioning that the greatest strength that Guard Your Eyes has is its greatest weakness. And like I've said before, Guard Your Eyes will lead you to water, will lead you to the water, but it has none for you to drink. if anybody disagrees with that, please speak up, you know, and say, tell me why. Because I'm going to keep saying it. And guard, unguard your eyes, and all these people know what I believe and why I believe it. And I'm sure that they understand this fully well. The greatest strength of Guard Your Eyes is secrecy, not anonymity, because it's not anonymous. Guard Your Eyes is not anonymous. It's secret. The structure of it is made so that no one will know each other. There's no relationship created automatically by being on Guard Your Eyes, and that's why people come on. People come on to Guard Your Eyes, excuse me, because there's no relationship established by being on Guard Your Eyes. Hello. Good morning. When you come on and the call is being recorded, the lady's voice says, this call is being recorded. So you can't be tricked into being on a call that's recorded and not know it. So that's a safety feature, Baruch Hashem, we have on Guard Your Eyes. I respect people's privacy. That's why I keep talking about this stuff. You're not here to hear me say these things, because some people I know feel like that's bashing Guard Your Eyes. Saying the truth is somehow bashing things. Also people say that there are many people who feel very strongly that it's disgusting what from people say that Torah won't answer you and you need the 12 steps or you need therapy or you need this or you need that. They're disgusted by that, and they say that that's insulting Torah, and that means that you don't hold from Torah, because Torah can do everything. So, that means that you should be able to hammer a nail into your wall using the Torah as well, which is completely stupid. So, you know, it's ridiculous. So, obviously, Torah doesn't do everything, because it's not meant to do everything. The next time you go to a doctor, let me ask you where the Torah is. So, whatever. So, it's not. I'm not insulting Guard Your Eyes by saying that Guard Your Eyes is lacking because of the secrecy. 12 steps groups are not secret. They're anonymous. No one comes into a 12-step meeting with a bag over their head. When you walk in, and that's the traditional milieu of 12-step work is the meeting. That's the classic milieu of 12-step work, the meeting, where people walk in and see each other and know each other, come to know each other and share their recovery one with another for free, just out of love, just free, no matter who you are. You know, you walk into a meeting, a chassidish lady walks into a meeting, any 12-step meeting of any fellowship, ANASA, GADA, blah, 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 you walk into... you're terrified because you're in Crown Heights. You're terrified because you're in Williamsburg. You're terrified because you're in the middle of Muncie. And it's terrified. So you drive, 27 miles out to a meeting in White Plains or something. And everybody in the room is a guy. And you walk in, and here you are, obviously Hasidish, obviously Yeshivish, obviously Orthodox Jew, or obviously a black person, or obviously, whatever. And you walk in, and everybody in the room is different than you. And every single person smiles and says hello when they have a chance, Every single person doesn't look down on you. Not a single person says, oh, If there were meetings in Mississippi and KKK territory, if there could be such a thing, they would have no problem having Jews in the meeting and blacks in the meeting and Jewish black transvestite women in the meeting. They would have no problem. They would accept you just like anybody else, because that's what 12 steps does. It's about acceptance of God's will. And if you're going to accept God's will, then you have to be accepting of people. That doesn't mean that you condone them, That doesn't mean you condone their values, but you accept them as human beings. And that's the important thing. I got an email. But just one more little second along this line. Just a few seconds more along this line. The secrecy of Guard Your Eyes is necessary because Guard Your Eyes is a public forum where everybody else can be secret. If there were AA meetings, SA meetings, or whatever, 12-step group meetings, where people could attend the meeting through like a dark glass in the wall where they can look through but can't be seen, Meitzitz Min HaCharakim, where you can look in and your voice could be heard, but no one else can see who you are, and you can attend a meeting that way. If such a thing were to exist, that would be exactly like Guard Your Eyes. Baruch Hashem, nothing like that can exist in a 12-step venue. No such thing. There's no such thing, and there never will be such a thing as 12-step meetings where you can attend without being seen. Now, there are phone meetings, but that's not the traditional 12-step meeting. Obviously, it's not. And it never will be. The in-person meeting is the only real 12-step venue because you are known when you walk in the room. Hi, I'm Alex, and I am an alcoholic. That's the core of AA. Rav Shmuel Yaakov Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to say that he said this at the International Association of Jewish Scientists or something like that. I forget. International Association of Jewish Scientists. They used to put out a magazine every week, every month, or every 2 months. But anyway, he was once invited to speak at their gathering, and he said a gorgeous thing. He said, you may think that since you're scientists and you're standing up for Torah true Judaism, which you are, that you're the ones who are saving Judaism. And it's true. You're going to save lots of kids, lots of teenagers, lots of adults who are having sfeikus in their Yiddishkeit because they look around them and they say, Gewalt, evolution must be the Torah's bunch of garbage. Universe is da-da-da-da-da. The sun is going around the earth. No, the earth's going around the sun. Seems to be in this sefer, this Talmud Chacham, this tzaddik seems to say the other way, Gewalt. So must be the Torah is bogus. And you're saving them by teaching them that it's not true. And this and this and that, you're frum and you're a scientist. You know all the science stuff and you're still frum. And you can help them like Rabbi Carmel and Cyril Dom and all these other people. You can explain to them how it's true and the science isn't to steer with Yiddishkeit, etc. And that's very good. But that's not why Yiddishkeit will survive from generation to generation. Yiddishkeit will survive from generation to generation only for one reason. As long as there are people who devote themselves to learning Torah, Yomam V'Laila. That's it. As soon as there are no more Jews who learn Torah, Yomam V'Laila, then Judaism will die. You know, as soon as there are Jews who don't learn Torah, Yom and Valayla anywhere in the world, Judaism will die. Because Rahman Litzlan, because that's the only thing that ultimately keeps us Jewish, ultimately. And in the same way, there will be people helped by Guard Your Eyes. There will be people helped by AA and SA and NA phone meetings. There will be. But the only thing that makes the recovery last as a lasting success in the world and is the reason why there are tens of millions of people who are sober today in gazillion fellowships all across the globe of all religions and races and, you know, socioeconomic status is because there are in-person, face-to-face meetings because of one addict helping another addict in person. And that's not secret. That's not Guard Your Eyes, and it never will be. That's anonymous. Anonymous means I know you, you know me, and neither of us share our identity with anyone outside this meeting of people. That's anonymous. Secret is Guard Your Eyes. And Guard Your Eyes uses this concept as its greatest strength. You can post the deepest, darkest, dirtiest secrets about yourself, and you will not get in any trouble because nobody can figure out who you are. Nobody. Okay? Nobody. And that's very important because if you were to reveal who you are in a public internet venue, then you just did the stupidest thing that you can do. Because Guard Your Eyes is like a giant AA, SANA, GADA meeting where there are thousands of quote-unquote participants who can see what's going on in the meeting with all the other people who have the guts to sit in the meeting in a circle and face each other, but yet not be seen themselves. That's what Guard Your Eyes is. That's what it is. And that's its greatest strength, that since you cannot be seen, you can tell the truth without shame and fear. The problem is that you're not telling it to anybody. There's no relationship being created. So your honesty is sterile. And AA could never have become created that way. And like the Ramchal says, the way that something is created affects the way that it works, and the way that it works is it demonstrates the way that it was created, the actual ofen that it was created, and that's exactly the way that it works here too. The way that 12 steps works is the way that it was created. The way that it was created demonstrates how it's going to have to work. It's one addict talking to another addict. You and I know each other because we meet and see each other. If I have so much shame from you that I cannot meet you, then I also don't trust you. If I don't trust you, then I'm honest, but not to you. And the big disadvantage of that is, specifically, is that on Guard Your Eyes, if I can tell you all the dirt about me, okay? If I can tell you all the dirt about me, then, hi, welcome. I can tell you all the dirt and disgusting, horrible things I've ever done, and I've never been honest with you. Why? Because you don't know the good stuff about me. You don't know any of the truth about me. You don't know that I am a father of seven, a rabbi of a shul, that I give chassan classes, that everybody holds me up in my chevron community as a person of such and such a stature. I have this kind of a personality that's very friendly and open, and everybody thinks that they know me and everything and this and that and I wear my tzitzis out because I want to be a demonstration, like the Chofetz Chaim says. I wear the king's garments in, you know, with pride and this. And you see me and you know all my good. That changes the meaning of all my bad stuff, quote-unquote, bad stuff that I do. That changes the meaning of it. It's like if you were to know who I really was, who I really am, and then think about all the bad, quote-unquote, things, all the sick things that I do and my disease and this and that, now you would go, oh, now I understand his pain. I never understood his pain before. It's not enough to say, but you know I'm a firm of yid, so you understand good enough. It's not enough. You know my struggles. You understand who I am on the good side. Now you know my pain. Now you know the truth about how disgusting and shameful the things that I did were and how why I've been hiding it so much and what a liar I am. You know the liar that I am. If I only tell you all the sick things that I did or do in my addiction, then you know how you might know how sick I am, but you don't know what kind of a fake I am. You don't know the level of my hypocrisy. That you don't know. That you don't know. Well, suffice it to say that I'm a firm guy, so obviously I'm a hypocrite. Isn't that enough? Do I have to shame myself? Do I have to clap on the bima? No, I'm not saying anything remotely like that. I'm saying opening up to other sick people like yourself is not the same as clapping on the bima. Clapping on the bima will get you ostracized from society because half of the people in the shul are probably addicts of some kind or do these behaviors without being an addict in some way and will shun you because kalaposo bemumo poso. They'll shun you because they're afraid of you because they don't want to be exposed themselves. And the other half can't relate to these disgusting things because they're just too good and they don't do this stuff. And they will despise you because they just don't understand you. So it would be a deadly, deadly error to open yourself up in public, almost as deadly as opening yourself up on Guard Your Eyes with all your personal details and who you are and where you are and everything, so that everybody will know who you are, even though many of them are meitzitz min acharakim. There are many people on Guard Your Eyes who are evil, horrible, destructive people, and they're only on Guard Your Eyes. And they might be on this call also. Oh, and I'm not being paranoid. This is obvious. 99% of the people are good people. I know that. 99% of the people are good people. But, of course, I believe that the majority are also not addicts. Baruch Hashem. But there are among the people on Guard Your Eyes and, people who are so confused that they will listen in order to destroy somebody sometimes. And if they figure out who you are, they're going to tell their wives and they're going to tell their friends. You can't have secrecy on Guard Your Eyes. You can't have safety without the secrecy. So Baruch Hashem, on Guard Your Eyes, there isn't anonymity. There is secrecy because it's not a safe venue. But once you're in a place where people are brinking their faces without bags over their heads, that, and admitting that they're addicts, nobody comes to a 12. Anybody who would rather die than come to a 12-step meeting, you're not going to walk in unless you're admitting that you're sick and you really have to. You're not on a roll. That's what you. No one comes into 12 steps on a roll. You know, I'm doing great in life. It's so good that I figured I would add 12 steps to make it better. You know, you're coming because you're sick, and you're walking in the room sheepishly. Everyone does, and in the beginning. And you feel like, oh, my God, I hope I'm safe. I hope I'm safe. And then you realize every single other person in the room is, of course, exactly like you. 12-step meetings will fall apart when people start coming and saying, I'm not an addict at all. I'm just curious about this because I heard about it in school. You know, that's not permitted. And that doesn't happen, Baruch Hashem. So I'm just trying to clarify something. I think it's such a precious point. If people disagree with it, if people who are listening or hearing the recording in the future feel like, my God, Dov is insulting Guard Your Eyes again, you know, you're wrong. I'm not insulting Guard Your Eyes any more than 12 steps adherence and 12 steps practice insults Torah. If you believe that 12 steps is an insult to Torah, then you probably wouldn't be listening to this anyway. Because that's all I'm about here, you know. I don't speak for SA, but that's what I'm all about, is 12 steps, you know, and I'm an SA member. But anyway, if you disagree with it, so then tell me and talk with me about it or with another member about it. Open up your mouth and talk about it, discuss it. Don't do name calling. Just explain why you think anything that I'm saying is mistaken, and what's the tachlis of the argument. Therefore, what? You know, that's the way that people are going to understand each other, and I'm going to learn too. You know. Anyhow, let me get back to this thing. This guy wrote me like this: "Hi, I once spoke with you on the phone for a very short time. However, I'm still struggling with my issues. I have a few questions regarding recovery. I struggle with masturbation for years already. However, I still cannot manage to stop and quit it and surrender it for good. It seems impossible for me to view myself living without it and stopping it for good. But what I understand is that surrender means is giving up the lust from an understanding that it is terrible for me. The issue I have with this is that I want to stop, but I feel like I did not yet see the consequences enough to decide that I must give it up. I'm always stopping for a few days and then fall again. What can I do to bring me to the realization that this must stop? And what does surrender mean? I would greatly appreciate if you can help me out with this." This is a gorgeous, gorgeous note by a beautiful person. It's dripping with humility and honesty and pain. And I love reading things like this. It restores my faith in my own self to be humbled and to be honest as well, like this person is. It's beautiful. So I wrote him back. "You are obviously an Ehrlicher and sincere Yid. But the ingredient that is missing is probably not your desire to stop and probably not your understanding about how important it is for you to stop. I'm not 100% positive about that, of course. It is possible that your suspicion is right and that the real truth that Hashem knows is that you do not actually believe you need to stop forever, but rather you truly believe that you need to stop for only a few days. And that would explain why you're stopping for a few days, because it's mission accomplished. I stopped for a few days, and mission accomplished. It is indeed possible that that's what's going on, but I doubt it. And even if it is the truth, I still believe it is not the entire picture." And then in the next part, I get to what I believe the missing ingredients here might be for this fellow. Now, I just want to say that there are many people who do 12 steps work for a long time. I don't mean unguard your eyes, 12 steps in your living room with a bag over your head, you know, make tzitzman aharakim, to see and not be seen, you know. That's not working 12 steps, because you've never opened up to another addict. And opening up on the phone is not opening up. Opening up without knowing each other is not opening up. Now, if you open up on the phone and you really come to know each other, then, you know, in other words, you know all the good stuff. You know what I do for a living. You know why I do it. You know you know my life, what kind of Yiddishkeit I practice. You know, what I do for a living is important. It speaks about the kind of person that I am. It really does. You don't have to know where I live. And if I can't tell you these things about me, that means I don't trust you, okay? That means that we can't help each other, okay? So, miman nafshach, you know, either grow garbanzos or don't grow garbanzos. You know, if you got the guts to act out and you're sick of it that much and it's that important to you, then find somebody who you can trust. Guard your eyes. A public forum of Guard Your Eyes like this call, which is the PIN number is publicly announced, is not a safe place to identify yourself. Okay? An in-person meeting is. Because an in-person meeting is the safest venue. Guard Your Eyes is the most dangerous venue to reveal yourself. Because the people who come into a meeting would rather die than be there. Every single one. is there only because he has to. And when you walk in, he knows that you're just like that. So everybody there is safe. And that's the way 12 steps survive in the middle of Williamsburg, Lakewood, Muncie, Bar Park, Flatbush, Crown Heights, and every other community, Jewish and Lahavdil non-Jewish, that SA and AA and NA, etc., meetings exist. The people in the meeting are ill, and we admit that to each other, all of us, and therefore we keep each other's anonymity. That's the 11th and 12th steps, not steps, the 11th and 12th traditions, if you read the 12 traditions. So, but on guard your eyes, nobody's promised, nobody's suffering to be on guard your eyes. All you have to do is, oh, there's a PIN number. I got an email. There's a PIN number. Ding, 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 ding. You know, please identify yourself. This call is being recorded, you know, whatever. You know, wow, what a sacrifice. I can sit on my phone and listen in the call. What a sacrifice. There's zero sacrifice. There's zero relationship. There's zero investment, except for your time, what you're doing for yourself. But anyhow, okay, I hope that I'm being clear about this. I'm really trying to be clear without hawking in a nasty way. So this guy is writing, so the guy's writing that I keep, it seems to be impossible for me to view myself living without it and stopping it for good. So that's what he wrote. That line contains the two answers that are the issue for him, I think. One is, it seems impossible for me to view myself living without it. Okay, 100% agreed. That's what's missing. Okay, he cannot see himself living without the sweet, delicious stuff. Sweet, delicious. That's disgusting. What are you calling it? Sweet, delicious, Dove. It's such a nasty thing to say. You're making fun of the guy. You're saying that he loves it. That means you're saying he's a mushless and a disgusting pig. And this. No, I'm not. I love it. That's why I'm an addict. If you keep coming back to something over and over and over again, that means that you trust it. When the going gets tough, that's where you go. You trust it. It's your go-to drug. You trust it to fix the way you feel. You trust it to make the time passable. Okay? And number two, you love it. You love it. If you're from Yid, you're a religious Catholic, you're this, you're that, and you just can't, you just have too much arrogance to admit that you love it. Because it's so wrong, how could it feel so right, you know? And you just can't bring yourself to that humility to admit the truth, then you're not on the same page with God. Because God knows you love it. It's obvious to him. And he doesn't spit on you. Open up a Tomer Devorah. Hashem still loves you and he still takes care of you, even though you're using his strength against your own neshama and against his Kvod Shemayim. He still loves you. He still takes care of you. That's love, taking care of you. He still loves you. He still takes care of you. You know? So nobody's putting anybody else down here by admitting the truth. So it seems impossible for me to view myself living without it because you love it. It's because it's so precious to you. That's why you're hiding it so much. You think the reason that you're hiding it so much is because you'd be embarrassed if people found out. Yes, you'd be embarrassed if people found out, of course. But you'd also be terrorized by the fear that you're not going to be able to maintain your free access to it. Because now your wife's going to know and she's going to watch you real tight now. She's going to watch you carefully now. You know? So you can't, therefore you're going to hide it. That's part of the reason why we hide this. Because it's too precious to us. It's don't see it, kivala es hakodesh v'mesu. It's mamish, it's parallel mamish to what the Torah says about putting away the klei hamishkan. You've got to cover them in an ortachash, because otherwise people will see when it's getting swallowed up, when it's being hidden away, when it's being taken away. They'll see it and they'll die. You know? What's the inyan? Because when you look
that when you expose Kodesh all the time, it becomes chol. It loses its Kodesh status.
You know, that's why the Or HaChaim HaKodesh, there's a maysa, a lion was chasing him. He opened up his pants so the bris was shown to this lion, and the lion ran away the other way. Why could the Or HaChaim HaKodesh do that? Because he wasn't like some of us exposing themselves. He wasn't a pervert. He was. That's why they call him Or HaChaim HaKodesh, because he never exposed himself. He never exposed himself, not just to people, but he was makbid on the Kedushas HaBris so much that not only did he never, ever come to sinning with his bris and with his sexuality, but he was mekadesh it in such a way that it was kikoin godel lifnai v'lifnin. And therefore, when he, you know, therefore, when this lion saw it, the lion was blasted by this kedusha. Normal people, aside from the fact that they're exposing themselves all the time by walking around in shorts and this and that, they're exposing themselves by, you know, doing other things and every, you know, the tznius is just not there. There's no tznius there. If there's no tznius there, then the madrega of the thing that you're supposed to be matznia goes down, 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 down. This is what the Gemara means when it says something along the lines of like, oh, there's nothing more disgusting than a drunk woman. You know, what's the Gemara putting down? Women? Is that what the Gemara is trying to do? Put women down and say, oh, women are no good. When they drink, they're just no good. You know? No, that's not what the Gemara is saying. The Gemara is saying that a woman is called Kavuta Bas Melech Panima, the Malchus, that a woman is supposed to and does embody by her birthright. When she drinks, she becomes Parutz, Prutza, and therefore it's the greatest lowering of what the, you know, of something that's the, it's not just that she's so Kodesh, she's so wonderful that it's a tragedy that she's Perutza now, that she's drunk and Perutza now. That's not what it's saying. It's saying much different and much more than that. It's saying that her Kedusha is something that if you hide it, then it's Kodesh and then it's great. If you don't hide it, even if she's not evil and doesn't sin or anything, if she doesn't hide it, then it becomes disgusting. Then it becomes not just it's sort of like the king laying drunk in the street. You know? It's a tragedy. It's just a tragedy. Not because of what could have been. Much more than that. Because of what is right now. It's a tragedy. It's a destruction of what the king is. He'll never be the same. It's a destruction of the king. The king must maintain his dignity. Tznius is ultimately about dignity. And that's what recovery is all about, dignity. Freedom of choice is all about dignity. That I have dignity, you know? You know, that I'm real, that I really am what I say I am, and that I'm, you know, that I keep my word, that I live according to a certain value. That's dignity. It's not what people see. That's not the point. The point is that it's real because I really do it. And this guy is trying to do it, and he can't. He can't even view himself living without it. He's lacking in that thing because he doesn't have freedom. He can't imagine himself living without it. This is one of the powerful advantages of meetings. If a person attends a meeting, an alcoholic attends a meeting, he meets dozens and dozens of people who are as drunk as a skunk like him and yet living without alcohol. And they're happy. And they're fine. They're living without alcohol one day at a time, and which I'll get to in a minute. And they're happy. They're living without it. So he can see, yes, it is possible to live without it. Until then, he just cannot believe that it's true because he's on Guard Your Eyes and he just hears about people doing it on the Wall of Honor for 347 days, blah, blah, blah. but he's not meeting these people in person, so it doesn't really seem real, you know. It just doesn't. It's just not 100% real to him. Therefore, it's not going to. Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Therefore, it's really not real enough for him. It's just. It's not gonna affect him properly. So that's one of the big advantages of meetings. It's not the reason to go to meetings alone, obviously, but the reason to go to meetings is to participate. So, but anyhow, the other thing is that. The other thing over here is that he writes. It seems impossible for me to view myself living without it. Now that's because, like I said, it's so precious to him itself. Taking it away would be a real tragedy in life. It would be like losing a loved one, God forbid. And the second thing he writes is, and stopping it for good. It seems impossible for me to view myself living without it and stopping it for good. He just can't view himself doing that. He can't view himself. He can't view himself stopping it for good. That gets into what I answered him in the later part of this note. I wrote like this, just using it because it's easier for me to concentrate. Thank you. I would instead suggest that the ingredient that is missing may be this. You do not really believe at all in the reality of living one day at a time. Instead, you see the entire idea of one day at a time the way most normal people do, and therefore most people on GYE, and many people in 12-step groups who first come, see it. Society has tricked you into believing that one day at a time means that if you can resist for today, one day, then you can resist for tomorrow. Just pretend that it's the first day or something along those lines. Okay? That's a trick. In other words, he's seeing one day at a time as a trick that people are playing on him, and that trick that he's being asked to play on himself. Okay? Excuse me for just a second. I have to silence the phone because of background noise. Hi. Thank you very much. Sorry about that. So what is one day at a time, and why is it relevant to this guy's struggle? People have tricked you to add the days together, counting, counting, and more counting. These are all lies and tricks that are ruining your success. Truly accepting that you will have no way of using lust in any way, not with your wife, not with your Averis, nothing today, that is missing here. You do not have any today. Every day you have is the first day in a series or the next day in a series. So you never start fresh, but rather rely on yesterday's momentum. That's a big mistake. And it's against the way that the Torah describes reality and time. And it also doesn't work, as you can see from your experience. And then I end and say, yes, perhaps you really do not believe clearly enough how important it is for you to stop. But I feel it is more likely that the missing ingredient is really your concept of time and reality. This can be corrected if you want to, but it means that there's no more glory of 90 days and all that wall of honor nonsense. The point that I'm trying to make here, okay, is in that next to last paragraph. And it runs like this. Truly accepting that you will have no using of lust in any way, not with your wife and not with your avarice, nothing today, that is missing. You do not have any today. So I said a lot over there. A lot of people, I just heard the noise of someone hanging up. It's like, guard your eyes. There are so many people on guard your eyes that their entire success is debunked on, let me have healthy sexuality, of course. The solution to this is channeling your sexual desire into your wife and using her, you know, to get out, to get your sexual desires out without being in an ofen that's usser. That's their entire understanding of, like, it's karshtetzach, that's what Hashem wants. Well, not for an addict, you know. An addict is somebody who can't have that drug. Abstinence is the only way. Does that mean that in sexual recovery we're talking about sexual abstinence? No, we do. There's nowhere do we talk about success being defined as sexual abstinence, that we have no sex anymore or that we don't enjoy sex anymore. No, we talk about lust, abstinence from lust. Now, if you want to talk in first grade or kindergarten about Kabbalah, so then ask the question now, a guy who's not sober, you're a guy who's not sober, I'm just, you know, setting up this scenario, you're a guy who's not sober yet, you've never been sober, and you're saying, what? Sobriety, how are you going to have sex without lust? That's what the Torah wants. That's what they want. It's like so confused. Is there so much confusion there? Of like, what are you talking about? The Torah doesn't want lust. You don't understand what we mean by lust, you know? So, like, what's going on? So let's not talk Kabbalah when we're learning how to lay in our parsha at our bar mitzvah lesson, okay? Let's just stick with the simple facts, okay? Somehow or other, the sneaky taking, grabbing, snatching, stealing looks, grabbing it, can't exist anymore with your wife either. Whatever you do has to be 100% open and acceptable and happy and comfortable together. Let's just stick with that simple definition of not lusting with her. Okay? The porn isn't what you're going to get with your wife ever, right? She's not going to be able to live up to that. You know, so let's not lie and say, well, I'll stop the porn, but then I have to get what I'm getting from the porn with my wife. You're never going to get, nobody ever is going to get the porn. Good morning. Nobody ever is going to get what he or she wants and looks for and gets from the porn from his wife, from her husband. That's not going to happen because that's fantasy land. Fantasy land is always going to be better than reality land. Every single time. And your heart versus your seichel, your heart, your emotions will win every time. In the end, your emotions will always win. You know, so what you really want is just a problem, and it needs to be faced. And what you really, really want is not really the schmutz. It's satisfaction, peace, and joy. And you don't get that from the schmutz, because I don't know anybody who's a sexaholic, who's compulsively looking at schmutz and stuff, who's happy doing it, whether they're religious or not. Even if we're not religious, we feel a sense of tension because of that stuff. And it always ruins relationships. It always messes with relationships. Eventually, even if you have the scenario where the husband and the wife both enjoy it and stuff, eventually it tears the relationship apart because it puts demands on the other person that they cannot fulfill. They cannot fulfill. And if they can fulfill them once, they can't fulfill them twice. They will eventually not be able to fulfill them. And if they think they can fulfill them partially, they can't fulfill them completely. It's just going to destroy everything. Lust destroys love. It just does. So that's that's that little tiny piece there. I just wanted to get past that little tiny piece. The ikker, though, is every day you do not have any today. That's the problem. There's nothing, there's no today for you. And that's against how the Torah defines today. There's a reason that Hashem begins the Torah by saying, not begins, but in the first perek there. Well, I don't want to say perek; that's from the church. In the first parsha there, in Bereshis, says Vayhi erev Vayhi voker yom echad, one day. It doesn't say yom rishon. It says yom echad. Now yom sheni is yom sheni, yom shlishi, yom revi'i. All the mafarshim ask, not all the mafarshim, but some of the mafarshim ask, why does it say Yom Echad? Why doesn't it say Yom Rishon? Isn't it obvious? Because what does Hashem say to you in the Shema? He wants you to keep the Torah. He doesn't say keep the Torah. He says keep the Torah today. And there are two different ways to understand that. One mafarish, and this is based on Midrash. One mafarish says that b'chol yom kipragmatia chadasha, or whatever that word is. It's a Greek word. I don't know exactly what it is. But it means like a new declaration from the king. Just came out, fresh, hot off the press. Every single day it should be something new. How the heck are you supposed to do that? Come on. Seriously. I've heard people say this a million times. Well, nobody ever explained to me how the hell are you supposed to do it? How do you make it a new... Oh, it's a new announcement from the king. Na, 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 close your eyes, it goes away, it's new. Ta-da! What does that mean, Lemaisa? What does that mean? Pretend? Is that what Yiddish kind of is? Pretend? We believe in Santa Claus, too? Like, what's going on? What does it mean? It should be in your eyes like it's a new thing. And other people teach it from the other side, saying that you're only commanded to do it for today. Okay? That the commandment is just for today. But they're really ultimately the same, because if you see it as a new decree from the king that just came out today, then that means that your perspective is, today is the first day of everything. It's the only day. It's not the first day of the rest of your life. That's sequential thinking again. It's not. It's the only day there is. The first day sets the model for everything else. There's only one day, stupid. That's it. There's only one day. What am I supposed to be doing today? That's the only thing that matters. Well, what about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? I'm supposed to daven for the whole year, right? Well, guess what? I never daven for the whole year on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I say the machzer, whatever the machzer says. But I don't daven for the whole year. I say to the Rabbanu Shalom, Hashem, help me do Yom Kippur right. If I do Yom Kippur right, you're going to know what to do with that, because you're very smart. You know exactly what to do with my Yom Kippur, my Rosh Hashanah. You know exactly what to do. In Kabbalah, they talk about, the Arizal talks about Rosh Hashanah as the Rosh, the Ramchal brings this, as the Rosh Hashanah. It's like the head of the year. There's a year, and there's a body, and there's the head of the body. That's what Rosh Hashanah is. What you think in your head controls what the body does. If you think in your mind, move your right hand, that's why you move your right hand. That's why your right hand moves. Your right hand moves because you will it with your brain. You will it in your mind, your Rosh. So your Rosh Hashanah is the Rosh Hashanah. It's actually the thing that creates what happens in the rest of the year. So I don't have to think about the year. I just have to do the Rosh correctly. And the year comes out by itself anyway based on the Rosh. That's what the Gemara means when it says that your Parnasa and everything is Katsuv Mirosh Hashanah. It happened already. It's done. Your Rosh Hashanah is made up. The Rosh is decided on Rosh Hashanah. So you don't have to think about the year. There's no reason to think about the rest of the year, because you don't do anything for the rest of the year
to plan. You don't plan the rest of the year out. You act a certain way. You think a certain way today, and automatically that affects the rest of your year because that's the way the universe works. That's just the way that the year is a body and your head is the Rosh Hashanah. That's what it is. All I have to do is do Rosh Hashanah right, and Hashem takes care of my year just the right way it should be. That's all I think about on Rosh Hashanah. That's why Al-Pi Kabbalah, the Arizal says, that's why on Rosh Hashanah, and the Hasidic Rebbe is also, they bring this, that's why it's so important on Rosh Hashanah not to think, not to be mekane on anybody, not to think down, look down on anybody else on Rosh Hashanah. That's the idea. It's essential not to think negatively of people, not to have anger in my heart on Rosh Hashanah, because it affects the rest of my year. I'm not planning out my year. It's just the way it is. You know? The only insurance that I have, the only thing I can do today to positively affect whether I stay sober tomorrow, or whether I stay sober for 25 years, or whether I stay sober for, you know, 60 years, or whether I have my 25th year anniversary of sobriety, the only thing that I can do I can't do anything to ensure that, to make it sure, but I can do something that will affect it. What is that? Stay sober today. And that's not a joke. That's not, yeah, you're right. Because today adds up. Because today adds up to the, you're going to be sober tomorrow. If you're sober tomorrow and you weren't sober today, then tomorrow is the first day. You know, no, that's not what I'm saying. That's because you can't think any other way that a person thinks that way. You're brainwashed.
So don't call it 2 day. Call it 1 day.
Yes, there is no such thing. So when the Torah. I mean, when God says, I want you to keep the Torah today, he means, I don't want you to keep it tomorrow. Chas v'shalom. He doesn't want you to keep it tomorrow? Oh, no. There's today. Today's your business. Tomorrow's not your business. It's none of your business. So, you know, is this religion? Hell no. Does Rabbi Twersky say that Torah and Tshuva are 12 steps and this and that? No, he doesn't say that. He knows that it's not. And he never said such a thing. And if he ever said such a thing, he didn't mean it that way. I've spoken to him about it. It's Derech Eretz. It's not Torah. And is there something religious about recovery and sobriety? No. There's nothing religious about recovery and sobriety. There never was and there never will be. You can turn it into something religious if you choose to, for yourself, but that doesn't make it religious. For you it is, but that doesn't make it religious. Not for me, not for him, not for her, not for anybody else. For me and for everybody else and for you, no matter how much you consider it Torah, Tshuva, and everything else, it's not religion, it's not Torah, and it's not Tshuva, and it never will be. If you're an addict, then it's not. If you're a regular person, then it is. For a regular person, it's about fighting the Yetzer Hara and winning. And that's exactly what you should do. If you're not an addict, you should be fighting the Yetzer Hara and beating him. That is your Yerusha. That is your job as a Jew, to do that. And that is what Hashem wants from you. If you're an addict, then Hashem doesn't want that from you. He wants you to focus on your survival. And if you're an addict and you don't see that you cannot do tshuva anymore because you can't sin anymore, you can't act out, you don't see that. Today, I cannot afford to do this any more than I can fly. I can't do it. Not that I mustn't do it. A religious person mustn't do it. An addict can't do it. It's an entire paradigm shift. As long as you see it as semantics, you don't understand. That's the difference.
That's why an addict can be sober for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, because he's got today. He can surrender today. As long as your surrender for today is a game, I'll surrender for today, and then tomorrow it'll be today. So, you know, I guess I'll be sober for another day, you know? That, as long as that's what it is, as long as it's a game, then, you know, you got yourself a problem.
You got yourself a problem.
You know?
It, then you're not surrendering, you're fighting. That's normal. A normal Yid's view of one day at a time should be that game kind of way. That's what it should be. You're fighting, you can fight for today. And that's all you're required to do is fight for today. For an addict, it's about surrender. You can't fight it. You can't fight it. You've been living your life trying to fight it. You can't fight it. Now, by the way, this is where the whole mistake comes in for non-addicts versus addicts in the other issue over here. The other issue over here is I don't know if I should go there right now. I don't know if I should go there right now. But anyway, I'm not going to go there. The fighting one day at a time like a game and adding up the days, if you're an addict, is mamish like holding your breath. Okay? Because you can hold your breath for 10 seconds does not prove that you can hold it for 20 seconds. Because you can hold, most people here can hold their breath for a whole minute if you really, really try. If you really try and you're not in, you know, you're not ill, if you're healthy, then you can hold your breath. Most people can hold their breath for a full minute. 1 minute at a time, one day at a time, 1 minute at a time means that if you can hold your breath for a minute, then that's just 1 minute. It's not the first minute. I don't want to hear about counting, schmounting. It's just 1 minute. You held your breath for 1 minute, you can hold your breath for another minute. It doesn't work that way. Try holding your breath for the second minute, and the whole time telling yourself, I'm really not holding my breath for 70 seconds. It's really just 10 seconds. The first 60 seconds are nice limb, and there's a new halois, and therefore it's 10 seconds now. Why do I feel like my lungs are about to explode? It's a kasha on a toisis, you know, it's apikorsis, you know, it can't be, because it's really only 10 seconds, because it's one day at a time, you know, doesn't work. No matter how, people don't like this example maybe, but no matter how hard you push today in the bathroom, you're not going to be able to go for tomorrow. It just doesn't work. No matter how deeply you breathe, you can't breathe for tomorrow. It just doesn't work. The next breath will come in its proper time. Lakol zeman va'es. Lakol chefetz asher, you know, tachas hashma. That's the way it is. That's the way it is. I've got one day at a time. If you're a non-addict, gizunter hate. Play around with whatever tachsisei mochama and tachbulis you want. You don't need truth. You just need to win. If you're an addict, you need to plug yourself into a higher power. And a higher power doesn't tolerate games, doesn't tolerate gimmicks, doesn't tolerate kinsenmachen. There's no more, I close my eyes, I'm going to pretend, one day at a time, doesn't work. There's an acceptance that I surrender completely forever today. It's surrender. I give it up. Does a normal person have to give it up forever? Not really. An addict has to give it up forever. A normal person mustn't sin. You must not sin. It's an avera. An addict, his or her motivation switches from must not to can not. I'm not able to sin. I'm not able to sin any more than I can jump off this building and fly. I can't do it. It just doesn't work.
The acceptance of that is step one. I'm powerless over alcohol. In other words, I can't drink, not to guard your eyes way that you see typically written. Powerless means that I can't stop. I'm just powerless. That's not what powerless means. I'm powerless over alcohol means I can't drink like a gentleman. I can't successfully drink. When I drink, I wreck things. When he drinks, he enjoys himself. That's what I'm powerless means. I'm powerless over lust. I can't successfully lust. When I lust and I use lust, I end up wrecking myself. I end up wrecking my life. That's what happens when I lust. It's not the pshat that it's usser. If it would be a mitzvah to masturbate and look at porn, things would be exactly the same. Exactly the same. I can't do it. It's Yehareg Valyava for me, not because of Torah, because of Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz kodma l'Torah. It pushes Torah right out of the way. It overcomes Torah. It supersedes Torah. It precedes Torah. It's more important, practically speaking, because without it, you have what the Gemara calls the inner keys without the outer keys. You can't get into the room. It doesn't start. It's game over. There ain't no game, rather, because you don't have the outer keys. You can't get in. That's what it's like for an addict. I can be frum. I have the inner keys, but I don't have the outer keys. I'm a freaking liar and a hypocrite. I got a double life. I'm a fake. Doesn't mean that I'm a fake in my mitzvahs. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. I'm living a double life. To every normal person, when they discover your secret life, to every normal person, none of your mitzvahs mean anything. Every normal person, every simple normal person sees it that way. Do I believe that Hashem sees it that way? Not necessarily. I don't know the way Hashem sees it. But everybody knows that a liar means you don't have anything. If you're a liar, then everything that you do is tainted by the lie. If you want integrity, if you want integrity and you're an addict, you need sobriety. If you don't have a double life, you just sin sometimes. I try to stay clean, and every year I masturbate. Every year? That's not an addict. That's not an addict. That's normal. That's why there's a mitzvah of tshuva. The mitzvah of tshuva is for the person who sins. The mitzvah of tshuva is not for an addict. An addict doesn't do tshuva and then return, and then do tshuva and then go back, and then tshuva and then go back. That's not recovery at all. That's not unsuccessful recovery. He has no first step yet. He's not an addict. He hasn't accepted the truth about himself. He's not an addict in his mind. He's not an addict. He's still struggling and fighting and trying to beat it. He's not an addict. He's still in that tshuva mode. Is it going to work for him? If he's not an addict, yes. It will eventually work. He will eventually go to the shiur that he needs to hear, the right thing. He'll eventually have the hisoris. He'll eventually get the dreidel spin, and things will work. Vinishamayim, he'll get that isurisa dila eila or whatever. He'll finally be motivated and inspired to do tshuva. Okay. If he's an addict, he's never going to get it. His life is just going to get worse and worse and worse over 30, 40 years. Guys coming to SA, guys coming to AA, guys coming to 12-step, and never really staying sober. Why? Never really staying sober. Why? 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 Because you don't really have it today. Now, yes, some people have psychiatric issues. I think we all have something. The Rambam says we're all chaloi hanefesh. Anybody with any mida issue is chaloi hanefesh. True. But for an addict, if he has chaloi, he or she has chaloi hanefesh, and he or she is not getting the proper psychiatric treatment for them, like you're suffering from depression, etc. So then, yeah, you're suffering from depression.
you might never be able to recover until you get psychiatric treatment for your depression. Is that an addiction issue? No. No. Just because many addicts have depression doesn't mean that depression is addiction. It's not an addiction issue itself, but it affects addicts. And you will not be successful in your recovery unless you treat your depression. So if you're running away from treating a psychiatric problem, then you're fooling yourself. You're Porsche driving on three wheels. You're not going to be successful. You need treatment. But if you don't, if you're getting treatment, or if you don't, or you know you don't have these problems, then guess what? You're probably just counting the days instead of living one day at a time. Living one day at a time is a double-edged sword. It means that I don't think about things like schar for sobriety. That, well, when I come to Olam Haba, Hashem's going to say, ooh, you were sober for 13 years. You were sober for 28 years. You were sober for 90 days. Oh, tremendous, you know. You got to throw, that's just not reality. That's not reality. If you're sober because you're an addict, then that means you're not doing it for Hashem. You're doing it for yourself. Okay? If you don't accept the fact that you're doing it for yourself, and you're still demanding, then you're going to demand schar, then you're not doing it for yourself. You're imagining that you're doing it for Hashem. It's a double-edged sword. There's no schar. Period. If that's not good enough for you, so then you don't deserve recovery. Sorry. If living sober isn't good enough for you, then you don't deserve it. You know? If you need the schar, you know, then that's it. You don't have a first step, because you still are operating under the rubric of, I'm doing it for the mitzvah, I'm doing it for Hashem, I'm doing it because of the Kedushas Habris, and blah, blah, blah. That doesn't work. That's Torah. That's not Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz is Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz. You know, I want to live. I'm powerless over lust. I cannot lust successfully. I would like to. Oy chas v'sholom, I wouldn't like to. I'm a ben Torah, I'm a this, I'm a that. Well, when your wife finds out all the things you do, try to convince her that you're a ben Torah. Okay, good luck. Good luck. You know? So why is that? Because she's closed-minded, she doesn't understand, blah, blah, blah. No, I don't think so. That's not the pshat. Because you're a liar. First and foremost, we're liars. When we're in our addiction, we're liars. That's the first and foremost issue. We're liars. That's the first thing. We're tricksters, we're manipulators, we hide, we fake, we pretend, we make excuses. You know, the wife comes in, we quickly close the computer. It's double life. It's a double life. It's a double life. That's the first thing. That's the main issue. That's the main problem. As long as your main problem is you're sinning, then you don't understand. You're running from the truth. Running from the truth. Kibareach min ha'esh. You know, as long as that's what's going on, as long as it's, you know, your mamish, a person like me, in my addiction, I'm a boreach min ha'esh. I run away from the truth as though it's fire. I hate it. I hate it. I hate the truth. I hate being known. I hate the truth. You know, I hate honesty. I like it in others, but I hate it in myself. I like when they're honest with me. Anyway, so one day at a time, understood the way I'm describing it, which I hope is correctly, or at least a good way to understand it, living one day at a time for real, it's a different perspective on life. It negates much of the motivation that we have to manipulate others, and it changes the way that we daven also. Because davening, and this is something that we can ask ourselves, when is davening not manipulating God? As soon as I hear the words koach hatfila, I am so turned off, I can't even tell you. The concept of koach hatfila, it's so risky. It's not a dirty word, but it's so risky. It's such a risky concept. how does that differ from manipulating God? You know? Look, you don't have to turn any further than the Gemara in Brachas. Gemara in Brachas. Ritzon Yireyav Yaaseh. Gemara in Brachas says, what's Pshat Ritzon Yireyav Yaaseh? Hashem does the will of Yireyav, of the Tzadikim. Example, a man, I can't remember who it is, Hamnuna? I can't remember. A certain man was suffering in terrible poverty, and his wife said, Gevalt, we don't have any food. Aren't you a tzaddik? Can't you daven? And he goes, oh, okay. So he davens, and a golden leg of a table appears in the thing, in their backyard or something, from Shemayim, fine. The wife is so happy, and she takes it in, and, you know, she's going to buy stuff and this and that. And then she has a dream that night that she and her husband are sitting at a table with three legs, and it's obviously ra'ua. It's obviously, you know, not going to stand properly. So she says, hey, what's with the three legs? And they say, well, you know, you used one of them in Olam Hazeh. And she wakes up and she says to her husband, give it back, give it back, give it back. And he davened in the Shemayim, and, you know, Hashem took it back. This is what the pasuk means when it says, "Estavasam yishma v'yoshien." Ritzon Yireyav Yaaseh, he does the will of Yireyav, of the people who fear him, the tzaddikim. Hashem does the will of the tzaddikim. "Veshavasam," and when they scream, "Yishma v'yoshien," because he did their will, but now they don't like it. Because until now, they were just accepting his will. Now, they started to be geyser on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he started keeping it. And that's not his will. They started to veer from his will. So, Ritzon Yireyav Yaaseh, Be'es Shavasam Yishma V'yoshiim, and their screams, he hears, and he saves them from the mess that they got themselves into by manipulating him successfully. Is this the kind of way that we want to be mispalo? Is this the way that we want to use our relationship with God? To manipulate him, to extort from him things that we want? You know, that's not what we really want. Now, as long as we're acting out sexually, that is definitely what we want. There's no question about it. That is exactly, precisely what we want. And we only want that. And you and I all know that.
Thou shalt not let me get caught.
Right, exactly. As long as we don't get caught. That's exactly what it is. We want him to do exactly what we want, the way we want him to do it. And, you know, to burn the candle at both ends and all this stuff. That's the core of our lives. That's why the core of the 12-step program is the third step. Not tshuva and this and that, but rather something completely different. Accepting God's will. Not doing what he says. That's not accepting God's will. Isn't accepting the Torah, mitzvahs that you've got to do. That's not the point of the third step. It's included in there, but it's not the focal point of the 12 steps, of the third step, which is the core of the entire program. The focal point of the third step is, read the words. It's accepting God's care. It's saying, he runs my life. You know? He knows what's best for me. As far as me and God, I'm generally passive. I accept whatever my life is hakna'a, like it says in Shmona Esrei, if you're lucky enough to daven Nusach Sfard, or Nusach Ha'ari, or whatever, you know, or different brands of Nusach Ha'ari. And if you're Ashkenaz, you can still say this. It's not against the minhag. This is from the Gemara. This is just the Gemara. They pulled it out of a Gemara. I think it's in Shabbos, but whatever. They pulled it out, Shabbos or Brochus. They pulled it out. There were these Tanoim and Amoroim, who mostly Amoroim, who after their tefillas would say such and such and such. And one of them is a Lekainetzor. One of them is tefillas Rav that we say every Rosh Chodesh, that in Ashkenaz, you know, Kehillas, we say on Rosh Chodesh, Sfard, not Sfard, but Sfardi, Kehillas, they don't say Birchas HaChodesh at all. They don't say the Yichirot and stuff at all. But one of them is this formula, I think, that is stuck in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei's, of the Elokai Netzor.
And that's, it says, Hashem, save me from the Yetzer Hara and put in my heart Hachna'a v'anava. Why is that the antidote for the Yetzer Hara? Because that's what it's all about. Hachna'a. Hachna'a. If I am machni'a myself to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, that means I accept his will for me. And his will for me is expressed in two different ways. One, by what he wants me to do, and two, by what he decrees happens to me, how my life unfolds, what happens to me. That's the other way that Hashem's will is expressed. And I ask you, and I've done this on this call before, and I'm going to keep saying it, which one is more in terms, just in sheer numbers? If you think about it, you'll see which one is more. Think about it. You'll see that his will for you, in terms of how your life unfolds, is overwhelmingly, probably thousands of times more percentage-wise and number-wise, thousands of times more, probably, in terms of percentage of the time and number of things and the scope of things and the, you know, in divrei rishus. How fat you are, how skinny you are, how rich you are, where your parents are from, what kind of an upbringing you had, your children, if you have them, or if God forbid you don't, if you find a shidduch, if you don't find a shidduch, who you marry, what she's like, how she wakes up in the morning, what side of the bed your boss wakes up in the morning, the traffic on your way to work, all the people in the traffic. A person has a car accident on the highway, thousands of people get delayed, it's Hashem's will, and he factors in all that stuff. That's millions of factors popped into there. And the guy that got into an accident, how did he get into an accident? Because he woke up on the wrong side of the bed. Why? Because last night his kid had a stomach virus and he was vomiting. And his wife and him got into a whole fight, and he was driving to work all distracted, and he smashed into the car behind him. And that's what was nishtalshel, this galgel, this whole thing that got me late to work. That's Hashem put thousands of factors in there. Thousands of factors. Hundreds of thousands. How many things, and then in terms of your parnasa and how you look, how you feel physically, your parents, your spouse, your children, your friends, the people you work with. These are all expressions called the Avid Rahman all the time. These are things the Avid Rahmana. These are all things that are expressing God's will is being worked for you. He's expressing, my will for you is this. My will for you is that. My will for you is the other thing. In hundreds of thousands of ways over the course of the day, how many things express his will for you in mitzvahs over the course of the day? 40, 50, 100, 300, maybe 1,000? I doubt it. I doubt it. You have a mitzvah of benching twice a day. So in two ways, that's two ways he wants you to bench. Okay, two ways he expressed his will for me today in terms of religion, in terms of mitzvah. But in terms of divrei rishus, it goes into the millions. Each day, b'chol yom tamid ma'aseh b'reishis, each day, his will is expressed to you in hundreds and thousands, probably millions of ways. What does that mean? That means that this is how he's... That means that this is God's will. Do I accept God's will? Do I accept the life that he's given me or not? That's the Shiloh. That's the whole Shiloh. Am I living with God or am I fighting God? How, I ask you, how is tefillah not fighting God? How is tefillah asking God for a life that's different than it is his will for me and you? How is that not fighting God? You know? And there's an answer. There's an answer. There is an answer. But I'm asking the question. I'm not answering it now. There's an answer. It is not fighting God to ask for things. I talked about this on a different call, by the way. But I ask you to think it over. When you daven, think over, am I trying to manipulate God? He's demonstrating his will for me. Am I being misnagged to his will right now by doing this tefillah?
And I know there are answers. And the answer for me is not satisfactory to say, well, he gave me this uncomfortable situation so that I should daven, and this and this and this. That's not the whole answer. Yes, it is part of it. Obviously, it's part of it. But that's not the whole answer. Then how am I supposed to look at tefillah? Then really, he doesn't want this thing to happen to me. Okay? And that's why he's that's why he put me in it, because he doesn't want it to happen to me. And he wants me to daven to say... People work it out in the Sifrei Machshava. They work it out to satisfy everybody and all that stuff so that they, so that, you know, we don't have these kashas and stuff like that. Except, please, what's really, really going on here? It's about a relationship. That's what tefillah is really about. It's about a relationship. How is it not manipulating him, though? Okay? So that's why in 12 Steps and in the Sifrei Chassidus, from tzaddikim like the Tiferes Shlomo and many other svarim, the tefillahs of tzaddikim were always for kavod shemayim. That was their tefillah all the time. Kavod shemayim. Kavod shemayim was the entire thing. The Tiferes Shlomo writes this straight out. That's the 11th step. That's the derech eretz. The 11th step is the derech eretz version of that. Because remember, the 12 steps are not religious. The 11 steps version of that, of davening all l'chavod shemayim, not for my sake, the Derech Eretz version of that is the exact lashon of the 12th step, of the 11th step, and that is praying only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. Okay? That's the focus. If a person's focusing on that, then they know that they're not manipulating him by praying. If you're focusing on what I get and what I don't get, then I ask the question. There are answers, but I ask the question. How do you know it's not manipulating? You know, anyhow. All right. Hey, have a hatzlacha dika day. Have a beautiful day. Enjoy the day. Hatzlacha. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.